security. All persons standing in this before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its honorable court.
A very good morning to everyone. The first case this morning is Benson against the United States Forest Service, number 034041. Ms. Haney.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Lee Haney. I'm counsel for the appellant. Jim Benzman, Mark Donham, and Hartwood. Your Honors, we're here today to ask this court to reverse the lower court's decision, remand the administrative appeals back to the Forest Service, and order the Forest Supervisor to issue a decision based on those administrative appeals. And in doing so, there will be a 15-day stay in accordance with the Appeals Reform Act. Your Honors, this is an Appeals Reform Act case. There is no citizen suit provision under that particular act, and therefore we are here today under the jurisdiction of the Administrative Procedures Act. Your Honors, the lower court and the opposing counsel have cited National Environmental Policy Act cases to support their arguments. Your Honors, I would respectfully submit that that is not applicable in this situation, that this is an Appeals Reform Act. The only relief sought is that the Forest Service will issue a decision on the substance of the administrative appeal. The theories under which the appellants asked for that relief are the equitable theories of estoppel and tolling. Your Honor,
before you get there, if the Forest Service were to reach the merits, would it have to give you a reasoned opinion? Or would it just simply have to say that it agreed with the decision that had already been made? Is there any regulation that requires it that it give you any more information?
Your Honor, the Appeals Reform Act specifically states, Congress said that that interested persons had 45 days from the day of decision, and then they may file an appeal. That's all that Congress said. They didn't include the newspaper of record. That is found in the regulations implemented by the Forest Service of the Appeals Reform.
And what do they say?
The regulations do say you count from the newspaper of notice. And they also say that people or citizens who have participated in the process get mailed. They are mailed the decision.
I think maybe you misapprehended my question or I misspoke. Suppose you did get the relief you sought, and we do require that the Forest Service look at this on appeal on the merits. What kind of a work product do the regulations say you have to get from the Forest Service? Can they simply say we agree with the decision below and end it, or do they need to give you some kind of reasoned elaboration? What I'm trying to get at is whether you have the right to any more information than you already have.
Yes, Your Honor. The form that the decision takes from the regional the supervisor, it says we either agree with the appeal or we disagree with the appeal, and then there is a, for lack of a better term, an order that goes along with it with reasons why the Forest Service either agrees with the decision or disagrees with the decision.
Is that a matter of discretion on the part of the appellate function within the Forest Service, or is there a regulation that requires that they give you that reason?
Yes, Your Honor. There is a regulation that requires that there be an appeal deciding officer. The appeal deciding officer makes a recommendation and uses and supports his recommendation with reasons. And then the regional supervisor either adopts the appeal deciding officer's recommendation or chooses not to adopt that. But that reasoning is part of part of the regulations implementing the Appeals Reform Act.
So I understand that your view is that you have the right to that information?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. We do say that there is a right to that information under the Appeals Reform Act. Yes, Your Honor.
And that's what gives you standing?
Yes, Your Honor. Standing is based on the harm that the appellant suffered. and the harm suffered is that their appeal was dismissed as untimely, and their appeal was not considered and rendered a decision.
Why isn't that simply a procedural right under the Lujan case and not something that would give you standing, independent, be an independent basis of standing?
Your Honor, we would argue that it does give us standing. It's more, not more in the line of Lujan, but perhaps more in the line of Aikens, where Aikens, the Supreme Court said there was more information that could be provided to the injured parties, and therefore they did suffer a harm, and therefore there was a case in controversy under Article 3. The plaintiffs in Aikens were uniquely harmed, unlike anyone else in the United States, other citizens. And that is the situation here. Mr. Bensman and Mr. Donham, on behalf of Heartwood, suffered a unique harm, unlike anyone else, because they had participated in the process.
Now, the district court thought one of your clients did have standing and the other did not. Given the district court's view of the basis for informational standing, how can we say that one of your clients has standing and the other one does not? This is a question I'll have for the United States in due course, too. It seemed to me the court's opinion is inherently contradictory.
Yes, Your Honor. We do see the inconsistency from the lower court's opinion. The lower court explicitly states that Bensman has suffered an informational harm. He could have received more information if the administrative appeal had had a decision rendered from the regional forester. And yet, in Donham's case, the exact same situation occurred, and there was no informational harm.
So if we're talking about informational harm as opposed to harm that has to do with the merits of the case, they seem to be similarly situated to you.
Your Honor, I would argue that, yes, they are in identical positions because, again, this is not a harm based on a tree being cut. That's the normal harm under like a National Environmental Policy Act case. But that's not the harm here. The harm here is the fact that the decision was dismissed as untimely.
Thank you.
Well, why do we even have to be worried about standing here? I mean, if we were to decide that the Forest Service has to hear this appeal, even though it was filed a day late, isn't standing something that they can? The Forest Service can either reject your case on it or not?
No, Your Honor. I do think we do have, obviously, we have to satisfy Article 3 requirements, standing.
But why is that a question for us?
Environmental plaintiffs, I agree that Lujan does require all environmental plaintiffs to have standing. The distinction between Lujan is simply that we're not under NEPA, we're under the Appeals Reform Act case. And I do see that it is a standing question because we're asking relief from you. We're asking you to order the Forest Service to render a decision on our administrative appeal. And, Your Honor, I would simply say that, you know, following that questioning, the appellants argue that we did not file a day late based on the information provided by the Forest Service, and that is the crux of this case. The crux of this case, what is undisputed, what is not subject to an interpretation in a declaration of standing or a declaration from the Forest Service, is that we have three letters, and each one gives them a date. You must file an administrative appeal postmarked by March 15, 2000, May 5, 2000, August 7, 2000. And each of those three instances, the appellant filed their administrative appeal on those dates provided by the Forest Service. This is a pattern and practice that they had been using for a decade. My clients, the appellants, do not have access to every paper of record by the Forest Service. And so they relied, and justifiably so, on the letters included with the mailing of the decision notice and finding of no significant impact. And for 10 years, it worked. Their administrative appeals were considered deemed timely, and there was a decision rendered upon them. And then, in these three instances, the Forest Service decides to change its mind, essentially. And again, this is a case of equity. Is that fair for the appellant to rely upon the information provided by the Forest Service for a decade and then the Forest Service change that method of communicating the date that the appeal is due. So I would say that yes, it was a day late after the notice in the newspaper of record, but I would argue that it was not late according to the information provided by the Forest Service, and that the Forest Service must be stopped from dismissing the appeal as untimely because of that conduct that it chose to participate in. And I will go through the elements of equitable tolling and equitable estoppel because it is important in the Seventh Circuit to make that distinction between tolling and estoppel. Equitable tolling is whether the plaintiff used due diligence in determining the date provided, and that in using due diligence they were unable to get the information they needed to file in a timely manner. Your Honors,
we have a lot of cases where people are a day late in doing something. This is 45 days is a lot of time to, in this case, file this appeal. Why do your clients and why do other people wait until the 45th day to do something? Why not do it at the 35th day and then you're sure you're never going to have an untimeliness problem?
Your Honor, as an attorney, I have often asked myself that question, why do I wait until the very last day to file my brief? And as an attorney, I do need, whether I have 30 days to file a brief with the court, I like to use all of my time to prepare the best brief that I can.
Well, preparing a brief is different than filing a simple notice of appeal.
Well, if you look at the administrative appeals and the administrative record, Your Honor, these administrative appeals are not simply we disagree with the decision notice. Sometimes these things are 20, 25 pages long, and they reference science, and they reference other cases, other parts. I mean, these are very detailed administrative appeals because the appellants take very seriously that they are part of the decision-making process. And if the decision is mailed to them, that may take 3 or 4 days. You know, it eats into that 45 days. And so I would argue that the appellants do need every day of that to do the best job they can on an administrative appeal and satisfy the requirements of the Forest Service. I see that I've gone into my rebuttal time, so I will.
Thank you, Ms. Haney. We'll hear now from Mr. Cohen.
May it please the Court, my name is Jonathan Koenig. I'm an Assistant United States Attorney in the Eastern District of Wisconsin, and I appear on behalf of the Forest Service this morning. I know it will astonish and amaze the members of this panel to hear that we live in an imperfect world where people make mistakes and where, in fact, the government even makes mistakes.
Reagan Company accepted, I assume.
Well, actually, no, Your Honor. That was precisely my point. I did want to call attention to a typographical error on page 42 of my brief. The word designed does not appear in the intended quotation from Singletary. And I did want to acknowledge that as an officer of the court. It was an unintentional mistake. In any event, we probably should not have relied on Singletary because that was not a case in which estoppel was sought against the government. And as we discussed in our brief, there is a heightened standard in those cases. I would like to talk about the two principal issues in the case. First, have the plaintiffs met their burden of showing standing? And if so, should equity come to their rescue, or should equity rescue them from their untimely administrative appeals? We heard Ms. Haney talk about informational injury. And according to the Supreme Court in Aikens, that occurs when a plaintiff fails to obtain information which must be publicly disclosed pursuant to a statute. There is no statute or regulation here that required the Forest Service to calculate or disclose a due date for the administrative appeal.
So this is simply a matter of practice then? They apparently do on occasion.
They did, Your Honor. As I believe the record reflects, the practice has changed and so has the regulation. The Forest Service no longer...
They no longer do it as a matter of fact?
That's right, Your Honor, because frankly it got them into trouble what they were doing, which was intended as a courtesy, sometimes didn't work out because, as in this case, for example, the publication dates in the newspapers would be earlier than anticipated, or someone would make an error in calculating the date.
Yeah, if you say that they give this date as a courtesy, say it's March 25th, okay. You have to file your appeal by March 25th. We say we do this as a courtesy, but then you say you don't expect anybody to rely on that. The government doesn't. That just seems to me to be...
Well, sometimes, Your Honor, something can be intended as a courtesy and go the wrong way. I mean, if you give directions to somebody who's lost out on Dearborn Avenue and they turn out to be wrong, they turn out to be wrong. But nevertheless, that was intended as a courtesy. And so our use of the word courtesy in our briefs was meant in that way.
Maybe I'm not looking at this right, but it just seems when the government says you have until March 25th to do something, and you do it on March 25th. The government turns around and says, we were wrong. It was really March 24th. You're out. That just doesn't seem that fair to me. But
well, Your Honor, I guess in a broad way, I would have to agree with Your Honor. But in terms of the strict legal requirements of estoppel, which requires affirmative misconduct, I could not agree. And in terms of equitable tolling, which focuses on the conduct of the plaintiffs, of course we have to keep in mind that we're dealing here with very experienced environmental activists who know these regulations, have used them before, and have calculated due dates on their own before.
So then you advocate a different rule if somebody was unsophisticated and not familiar with the processes. They could rely on the government's courtesy?
I think in applying an equitable rule, what is reasonable would depend on the parties involved. Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Conan, if...
I tried to research that point, incidentally, and I didn't have any luck finding a definitive answer.
Mr. Conan, if that is the government's position on so-called right to information, why then have you taken the position that one of the appellants does have standing and the other does not? I can't see where, with respect to the right to this information, there's any distinction between the position of either one of the appellants.
Your Honor, we have conceded throughout this litigation that Mr. Bentzman has what I would call traditional standing with respect to the Chadwick Trails project.
Because he was more active in using them?
Yes, Your Honor, and the details escape me. I believe he did a declaration which is part of the record.
But that might give him, as you say, traditional environmental standing.
Yes, sir.
But does it give him standing to make the argument that he has been denied this information? You, in your brief, very eloquently tell us why his co-appellant does not have that informational standing. But wouldn't your reasoning apply as well to Mr. Is it Bentzman,
sir?
Bentzman.
Yes. Yes, it would. Or at least I'm not aware of a principal basis for distinguishing the plaintiffs on the informational injury question. Before going ahead with my presentation, I did want to respond to your question, Judge Ripple, about whether the deciding officer in the Forest Service is required in issuing a decision in the appeal to provide a justification. The only thing that I'm able to quickly locate in the record is 36 CFR 215.18, which does not, again, looking at it very quickly, require the deciding officer to provide a rationale for the decision. Briefly, I would like to talk about what I referred to earlier as traditional standing, but I'd like to mention also procedural injury, which is another theory advanced by the plaintiff in this case. I think this court, in its earlier Hartwood decision, in the Rhodes decision, and the Supreme Court in Defenders of Wildlife, all acknowledge that there is no freestanding procedural injury. In Justice Scalia's words, an individual can enforce procedural rights so long as they are designed to protect some threatened concrete interest of his that is the ultimate basis of his standing. Which brings me again to what I would call traditional standing criteria. Injury in fact is how it's sometimes referred to. Under this standard, again, as outlined in Defenders of Wildlife, the injury must affect a concrete interest and it must be actual or imminent. Again, we've conceded that Mr. Bensman has standing of this kind with respect to Chadwick Trails, so the question in terms of standing is whether Mr. Donham has standing with respect to either Plantation Lakes or Pole Lake. Mr. Donham lives in Illinois. Plantation Lakes is located in the Ottawa Forest, which is in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. He's visited there 4 times in 20 years and says that he intends to return to the area and would seriously consider someday buying land there or spending more time there. The Defenders of Wildlife case, again, holds that past visits to an affected area combined with, quote, someday intentions of returning are insufficient to establish standing for purposes of Article 3. Mr. Donham's connections with the Pole Lake Project are even more attenuated. He says that he's driven through the Hiawatha Forest, again located in Michigan. He's camped there, but not necessarily in the area affected by the project. And I would just like to emphasize that we're talking about a forest, in the case of Hiawatha, that's around 1 million acres, perhaps slightly less, and that the project affects a fraction of a percent of that property. His someday intentions of returning don't establish standing, and under the National Wildlife Federation versus Lou Jan case, visits to unspecified portions of immense tracts of territory also do not suffice to establish standing. Your Honor, I think we've already touched on equitable estoppel and equitable tolling. For estoppel, the government relies on Lewis versus Washington, which makes clear that when asserting equitable estoppel against the government, you have to show, in addition to a representation and detrimental reliance, affirmative misconduct on the part of the government, which is missing in this case. What we had here was arguably negligence, bungling, what have you, but it was not affirmative misconduct. And then equitable tolling, I would refer your honors to Wilson versus Battles. We've discussed already whether the court should take into account the background and experience of the litigants, if the government's position that the court should.
Mr. Koning, before you sit down, if I may, take you back to an earlier part of your argument. Both of these gentlemen, I understand, did they have a right to receive notice of the original decision of the service?
I believe that once you participate in the process by submitting comments, that it's certainly the practice of the Forest Service to notify those people when there's been a decision. Whether it's a right, I'd be hesitant to say.
It's a courtesy.
It might just be a courtesy.
Why wouldn't that status to be notified about the original decision be sufficient to give them a right to participate in the further proceedings, the appellate proceedings, irrespective of whether the appellate section is going to write anything more or not? I mean, what they're basically complaining about here is that they missed the gate because of either equitable estoppel or equitable tolling. Well, if they had a right to participate in the appellate proceedings, why isn't that enough in and of itself?
Your Honor, I guess I would respond by saying that a right to receive notice, if it exists, is not the same as a right to file an untimely appeal.
Mm-hmm. This is simply a procedural right. nothing more.
Well, and again, the government's position is that a procedural right standing alone doesn't give you standing. So I hope I've answered your question.
I think you have. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. We would ask that you affirm the district court.
Thank you. Ms. Haney has some time left. You have 3 minutes, Ms. Haney.
Your Honor, the Forest Service conveniently ignored the Shropshire decision, and that is a very important case in the argument of the appellant. The Shropshire decision talked about the blameworthy conduct of the, in this case, the government agency. Your Honor, the appellants argue that the provision of a specific date without any kind of clarification or without any kind of warning that this is not correct information, that is blameworthy conduct. And Shropshire from this circuit clearly says that blameworthy conduct can grant a petitioner or a plaintiff the relief sought under equitable estoppel. And, Your Honors, we would simply continue that the heart of this case, the only reason Heartwood filed this lawsuit is because of those letters. That is the heart of the lawsuit. Yes, we have to address standing because to seek relief from a court of law, we have to show there's a case in controversy, and we have met that burden. But the heart of this case is an equitable question. It is not a legal question, and yes, equitable relief is unusual. Some might even call it extraordinary, although that's probably not the term of art to use. But the appellants, with the history they have with the Forest Service of participating in the administrative procedures provided by the Forest Service, saw this case as extraordinary, saw this case as unusual, and very purposefully, deliberately, and cautiously come before this court and say that equitable tolling and estoppel is relevant and should grant the appellants the relief they seek. The only relief they seek is that the Forest Service render a decision on the administrative appeals. There is no substance. There's no request that a tree not be cut. It's simply asking for information that the decision be rendered. And so I would respectfully point to the court that is the issue here. And the Forest Service states that if an individual in this courtroom gives directions to a person asking from out of town where to go to Dearborn Avenue and they give wrong directions, well, that was a courtesy, but it was misinformation. That is inapplicable in this situation because we're not talking about two strangers meeting on the street randomly. We're talking about the U.S. government and a citizen, and that relationship is definitely a higher relationship than two strangers.
So if a citizen stops a police officer at a street and asks him where the address in Dearborn gets misinformation, he has a cause of action against the policeman?
No, Your Honor, he does not, because there is no law that says a police officer shall give correct information, but there is a right to appeal under the Appeals Reform Act.
Oh, yeah. But it doesn't say anything about information.
It says that a citizen has the right to
appeal,
and they may appeal if they participate, if they have taken...
Yeah, I understand that, but there's nothing that says they have to give you directions on the time or anything.
Well, there is regulations that say that they have to render a decision on that appeal.
Oh, yeah, but there's nothing about telling you what time you have to file.
No. No, I agree, Your Honor. That is true. But again, I'm sorry. Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel. We very much appreciate the quality of the oral arguments today. We keep the case under advisement.